This is Gene Lozano, the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. Thank you, everyone, for having come this morning for the demonstration. Those of you who were unable to do so, I'm sorry you missed this opportunity. Perhaps we may be able to do this in the future. And from now, from 10 to 10:30, we're going to have kind of a debriefing session. Bernice, before we get into it, are there any things that you would like to say, Bernice?
I hope everyone found this morning's experience informative, and it will help us to formulate some plan of action.
Okay. Thank you, Bernice. I first want to thank Bob Windler, who is the director of training at the Guide Dogs of the Desert, for bringing his staff and friends here and helping us with this demonstration. I'm going to turn over for the next half an hour, let him talk a little bit about what things that he and others have discovered about using the hybrid car, maybe perhaps tell how they got it, and how they're incorporating the knowledge they're acquiring for the training of their teams. And then we're going to have that, and then give you an opportunity to express your feelings and so forth about the subject. And just to give you an idea, what else is going to happen the rest of this morning is that from 10:30 to 11 o'clock, we're going to showcase three different exhibitors that have products here. They're dealing with access. And I just thought that sometimes it's a little hard for us to find these, just to learn a little more about this. And then we're going to have, from 11 to 12, we're going to have a representative from the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transit Authority to talk about what access that they're providing in the fixed route and rail system for people here in the greater Los Angeles area. So I'm going to turn over the mic to Bob. Please give him a hand.
I got one here. Thanks. Great. Thanks, guys. Everybody hear me back there all right? Sometimes I kind of get excited and overspeak. Sometimes I can go without the mic, but for the safe sake of you guys, I don't want to play quiet car on you up here, so just let me know if you can't hear me. Anytime I get an opportunity to come to an event such as this, it's very rewarding for me because I'm able to not only share, but I'm able to see old friends and people that I worked with over the past several years and to share things and to share knowledge. And basically that's what we were asked to do here. And quiet vehicles, and I talked a little bit about it outside, are here to stay. And it doesn't make any difference how much you or we as service organizations jump up and down and stomp our feet. It's going to take a while to change it, and we all know that. So what do we do in the meantime? And what we need to do is to work together to help educate one another on how we can help one another make this as safe as possible. And those of you that were out there and witnessed that vehicle when it was standing still and idling, realize that poses a real danger. And they're going to continue to be manufactured. Cadillac Escalade came out with one. So they're putting them back in bigger vehicles. Every manufacturer out there is going to be going to this type of technology. And you know that it's going to take litigation after litigation after litigation to get any changes made. So what do you do in the meantime? You prepare yourself. You put water wings on before you jump into the water if you don't know how to swim. So that's what you need to do to take care of yourselves here, is to educate yourself, to get as much experience around these types of things as possible. Talk to your mobility instructors if you're getting cane, if you're getting cane travel. See if they can get somebody to help you with that. As a guide dog school, talking with graduates and saying, what is your feeling about this? And they're going, it scares the hell out of me. And rightfully so. Because I was taught with a vehicle that makes noise. More importantly, my dog was taught with a vehicle that makes more noise. So the dog had been conditioned to listening to that particular type of a vehicle. So what can we do as a school to improve the chances of our graduates and the chances of our dogs having a better understanding as to what it is that, that can be expected when you go out there in the real world where these cars are out there. And what we our program does is, number one, we put out there to Toyota that this was a concern. You as consumers have put out there to car manufacturers that this is a concern. And in some cases, Toyota was listening. And I was impressed by that. We need to make sure that they all listen. Because you guys know that you stomp up and down enough and you squeak enough, in time you get greased. And that's the important thing. And I think you'll find that, that any of the schools out there will help be advocates for you when you talk about this, because it does directly affect our training and our dogs. So getting your schools to, together and getting this type of technology for their training, I think, is going to be a great benefit to you in the long run. So that's where I'd start stomping my feet. It is getting all the schools together on trying to get a vehicle like this. Our particular program, when we're training our dogs, what we call traffic training, is we do a minimum of three formal traffic training sessions with our dogs at various stages of training. My philosophy in training is to show, teach, and test throughout a dog's career, puppyhood into formal training. So during those phases of training, we're going to show the dog what a vehicle is all about. And then that stage, I use the old-fashioned vehicle, something that's typically used, what you see on the street every day. A vehicle that makes a little bit more noise might be a little bit more intimidating to your dogs so that they get an understanding of what vehicles are all about. You guys have to understand, those of you that are dog users, that when teaching a dog traffic awareness, and that's a big word, awareness, your dogs cannot fear traffic. If they fear it, you're never going to get across the street. If the traffic is, and you guys don't know that everybody stops behind that white line, right? It's the law. It's the law. You have to stop behind that white line, and everybody does. So those people that don't stand behind the line, anyhow, if that vehicle is running and your dog's taught to fear traffic, you're never going to get across that street. If there's a car waiting to make a right-hand turn and your dog fears traffic, you're never going to be able to get him to step out into the street. So dogs can't fear traffic. They have to respect it. And we teach the dogs how to respect traffic during some formal training sessions. And I've talked to instructors from all over the United States and other countries as well. And traffic training is somewhat similar throughout all the different schools. You know, there's a lot of similarities to it, but bottom line is the dogs have to respect and not fear traffic. Thing people don't understand is that dogs do not understand the concept of speed and distance. So in other words, dogs are taught a particular buffer zone, but they don't understand that if you're crossing in the middle of an intersection, mid-block, instead of going down to the corner like your instructors told you to do, and you're crossing mid-block, your dog can't look down the street and said, there is a vehicle traveling at 49 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone, and it is 280 feet away from us. Your dogs don't understand that. That's where the responsibility goes to you as a cane traveler or as a dog user to determine when to go. What we do at Guide Dog Schools is teach dogs how to respect a particular buffer zone around you if you've asked the dog to do something. So reality is that a guide dog is nothing and continues to be nothing more than an extension of your own good orientation and mobility skills. The dog is a buffer. The dog's a backup system. Dogs make mistakes. A lot of sighted people get hit every day. A lot of sighted people get hit by cars every day because they're not paying attention. It's not only scary, those quiet cars are not only scary to people that are cane users or partially sighted or totally blind or guide dog users. They're scary for kids. They're scary for elderly people. They're scary for able-bodied people out there. So what does that tell me? That tells me that we all have to do what we can do to make ourselves more aware of the fact that that threat is out there. So we need to do what we need to do to pay more attention to what's going on out there. Don't take advantage, don't take for granted. Don't expect the state legislatures to take care of it for you. For crying out loud, they said it's against the law to talk on a cell phone without a device in your ear. It's still legal to text. Tell me you're going to get some help up there at the state level right away. I don't think so. Educate yourselves, help yourselves out. Talk to your schools. Do whatever you can do to help protect yourself. Going back to our particular training program, after the dogs understand that vehicles are something to be respected, we get a little bit quieter car. And that's when we get to the testing phase. Let's find out whether or not the dog understands what we've shown him over the past. And then later on in training, we use a quiet car so that the dogs gradually learn and understand and to respect that vehicle, whether you can hear it or not. The fact of the matter is it's moving, and it's moving within that safety zone, that buffer zone that you've been taught to protect. But there's no guarantees. The only guarantee is you making sure you've made the right decision. So when in doubt, wait it out. And something that I've been telling my folks for a long time is that it's better to be patient than to become one. So you need to pay close attention as to what's going on out there. We're not going to fix this right away. And it is just a fact of life. So what can you do? What can we do? And that's to work together to offer programs like this. To give people an opportunity to experience the reality that's out there. I've been working with dog trainers. I've been training for a long time. There's some experienced dog trainers in this room. I think that they would probably agree with me. I'm 100% sure that your dogs hear that vehicle when it's sitting there idling. Whether or not there's anything else going on, whether there's a radio on, whether it's humming, whatever. Your dogs know that it's there. But it's not your dog's responsibility to know when to cross. If you're a dog user, it's your responsibility. So that's where the danger lies, in you determining when it's time to cross. It always helps when somebody honks their horn and waves at you. Go ahead and cross. That helps, doesn't it? Your dogs understand that. Your canes understand it even more. Yeah. So, bottom line, you guys, is to be real brutally honest with you, there's not a quick fix. I can't get your dogs to fix it. Your mobility instructors aren't going to get your canes to fix it. The responsibility right now is going to go back on you. And so I would urge everybody to just be careful out there. Dogs are a backup system for you. Your canes are a form of identification for you. Yeah. So, I can't think of anything else, but what we can do is we can open it up for questions. We have a couple of runners here that can go by. Chairman, do you have anything?
Let's go ahead with that. Okay, Bernice would like to say something first.
At our banquet Saturday evening, we will be honoring State Senator Lowenthal. And the reason is that he introduced a bill on the issue of quiet cars. It passed both houses of the state legislature, and it was on the governor's desk. And if the governor had not taken action on it by the 30th of September, it would have gone into law. On the 30th of September, he vetoed the bill. So we want to be sure to thank Senator Lowenthal for attempting to assist us in this issue, and I'm sure he will continue to help us with that, and we just need to let him know that we still need his support.
Also, if you haven't had an opportunity to go through your program agenda this afternoon, Dr. Lawrence Rosenblum from the University of California, Riverside, has been designated as a researcher on the subject on the national level, who's going to come and talk a little bit about the work that he's been doing in this area of the quiet cars. He's also been hired as a consultant by the National Federation of the Blind on this subject, and I believe he's had some input with the work that's being conducted at Stanford University by some university students coming up with a means of producing some sound. So I think it'll be very interesting to hear what he has to say. We should keep an open mind on that, and what your experience you had this morning, you might be able to give him some feedback. So let's see what you have to say now. And Bob will be the one identifying who it is, and we'll deal with the questions.
If you just mention your name real quick, please, so everybody knows who's.
My name is Abby Vincent, and I think one of the reasons, or maybe the only reason why Schwarzenegger vetoed that bill is he said it wasn't the state government's responsibility, that it's a federal issue. Well, if we want to be advocates, who do we go to? Do we go to every single car manufacturer that there is and try to get them separately to put some kind of a sound-emitting system on these cars?
This federal legislation that Mitch Pomerantz will be talking about this evening, that ACB and the National Federation of Blind have been working on a national level to seek funding for research.
So am I to understand there are no quiet hummus? I didn't say that.
Any other questions?
Yeah, there we go.
Hi, my name is Melissa Hudson, and it was mentioned earlier that GDD as a school had talked to Toyota and had some feedback. I'd like maybe a little bit elaboration on what was discussed or what, you know, they had come back with or what you guys talked about.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Toyota, it was brought to their attention through other media events and access that there were some issues, and they actually came to us and asked us whether or not we felt that this was a potential problem. And obviously, as dog trainers and having some mobility instructors and some of our graduates advocating to see what we could do about educating car manufacturers such as Toyota that this was a potential problem. So Toyota did contact us and came out and observed some dogs being worked, observed dogs being trained. We put a couple of people from Toyota under blindfold and asked them to cross the street. We got a free Toyota. And we continue to try to get as much press as we possibly can to not only advocate for people that need to have experience and training in this, but you know, if you grease that wheel of Toyota and tell them what a great job they did, they want to continue to do as much as they can to get good press, because every time somebody gets damaged by one of these cars, that's a lot of bad press. So if we can get out there and help them understand that they can help themselves by doing what they can to make things safer for us, I don't know, I'm going to take every advantage that I can to get them on my side.
Good morning. My name's David Jackson. You talk about the responsibility of both cane and guide dog users. As a person who has a wife who has a car and drives and pays insurance, don't the insurance companies have a vested interest in their rates in terms of injuries? I'm thinking of a two-prong situation. So you go to your legislator, and if you're an insurance payer, you go to your insurance company and you say, "Hey, look, this is going to be the norm in the next 10 or 15 years, where these cars are going to be it." I would think that the insurance companies would want to take a vested interest in figuring out a way so that people don't get injured by being hit by a quiet car. That's just a comment.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing. And the more we can educate one another and the more that we can get that out there to the people that are going to make a difference, it's like I said, we're not going to make a difference. It's big business. It's people that are spending money, insurance companies that are spending money because things have happened that are going to make the differences. And you guys both know that you don't get a signal put in somewhere until somebody gets run over. Try to get an audible signal put in. Well, how many people have died? Only two? As soon as the third one gets hit, we'll discuss it. So, yeah, you want to get as many people that have as many vested interests involved. I would think, yeah. The more we can educate, that's kind of what we're doing here, is sharing information and educating.
Yep. Any more questions?
I think we got
one
more, yeah.
Hi, I'm Linda Simulski. I am the Student Services Coordinator at Guide Dogs of the Desert. And it just occurred to me that one of the things that we might be able to do is go to our nearest Toyota dealer and as advocates and ask them if they would mind promoting an incentive for the cars that are already out there to come in, and as you know, because people have to go have their car serviced. So when they go in, if they could, when they figure out what kind of a noise they want to use for the Priuses or for the quiet cars, the hybrids, when they go in, that they could have that put on their car, and then they would get some kind of either discount the next time they go to get their car serviced, or a tax break or some kind of incentive to do that. And that would really be helpful. And it would be promoting, our cause as well.
I think all dealers need to be educated to the fact that it's their responsibility in selling these vehicles, that they educate the buyer. And whether it be done in the owner's manual or verbally, hey, be aware that this car poses dangers. I mean, for crying out loud, if you get inside of a car and pull down the visor, there is a sticker there that tells you all about seat belts and airbags, and I don't care how hard you try to get those off. They look like crap on the inside of the car, and I have tried everything to get them off my visors. You can't get them off. But if there was something on there in those quiet vehicles that had a little picture of a little kid or somebody getting run over because if it's a quiet car, it paints a picture in their minds. I don't know. I think it's education. If we could get the dealers to do it. It's not just Toyota. Cadillac's making one. So how are we doing on time? Okay, we got time for a few more questions here. Mary's running around with some deals. I'll try to be brief with my answers. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, Richard Moore, San Gabriel Valley chapter. I almost think we're going to have a few sacrificial lambs. Last month there was a Metrolink accident that killed 25 people at once. So maybe that's what it's going to take. And I hate to say it, but that's the way it is. Now they're finally straightening up the Metrolink situation and putting in extra engineers, putting in a fail-safe system to, you know, keep people from going through the switches. Maybe that's what it is. The cost has to go up to the manufacturer high enough so that they do something on their own.
Unfortunately, there again, it was driver error, and it's never be too sure. Christy?
Two things. First of all, I think people need to know that not only can a lot of us not see, but our hearing is also going. And the way I traveled when I was 20 is certainly not the way I travel at 55. So, and there are more of us. The second thing is that I think one of the things that our organizations need to do, both CCB, ACB, and FB, is to begin making public service announcements about these quiet cars and not making them negative, but just basically saying, remember, your car is quiet, and, you know, some kind of a clever yet saying that brings it home. I think we need to start with PSAs, and they're free.
Great point. And just so other people know, I was there when you were doing 20 miles an hour before we were 55 years old.
I have a question. My name is Pedro Romero. I'm curious, how many miles an hour does the Prius have to go down to before you no longer hear the engine?
It's not necessarily miles per hour. It's how much torque is required, and in braking, once the car gets to within a certain speed, most of the time that engine will kick down. However, if I'm starting from zero and I accelerate because I need to get up to speed to cross an intersection or enter the freeway, the gas engine kicks in, and then it slowly downshifts itself to where once we get to the position where the vehicle is idling, it goes back into battery stage. Hybrid vehicles have a gas motor, and what happens with them is they're constantly, when the gas motor kicks on, they're constantly recharging the batteries. That's the reason we don't have to plug them in like a golf cart. They recharge themselves. So that's what you were hearing out there. Once that motor kicked off and then it turned on to whatever the charging system is to chill that battery, and then it gradually tones itself down until you get that silent mode when it's just sitting there idling. Okay, does that answer your question? You're welcome. Wow, well, that's great, guys. I'm going to hang around our booth for a little while today. We're out into the ride out there. I've got some friends here from Cheese Country. There are some dog trainers out there. You might want to talk to them a little bit. Their experience, I don't know what they're doing out there in Wisconsin. It's not helping the deer. But
Bob,
he brought me some really good venison jerky. So anyhow, thank you guys very much.
Bob, could you just tell them very quickly about the key, what's taking the place of the key, the newer technology?
In a lot of vehicles now, I mean, everybody knows what a set of keys looks like, and that's what all of our car vehicle keys used to look like. Every manufacturer has a little bit different style of a key, and the key fobs for this particular vehicle looks like a 9-volt battery. It's just this flat little rectangle thing that fits into a receptacle in the car. And you don't crank the key to the left or to the right. This activates the battery, and it's one of a kind. This is not like going down to the locksmith and having them grind you a new key. If you lose this and the spare, you need to call Toyota. They need to get the number. You need to get your credit card out, because it's going to cost you about $400 to replace it. So keys have changed a lot. This has a computer chip in it. Most of you that family members or have newer cars have that little computer chip in them where you've got a little lock and unlock system. You know, they're very expensive too, but keys have changed themselves. And the key system on this goes in, it activates the batteries, and then you have to start the vehicle. So, guys, that was great. Hopefully everything was informative for you guys. I enjoy coming out and visiting and sharing, and hopefully it helps you guys become safer out there. So good luck. Travel safe.
While we're waiting for... thank you very much, Bob. And while we're waiting for our three vendors to come up front, I want to make an announcement that tomorrow we will have in the Santa Cruz room an opportunity for people with low vision to evaluate some prototype emergency evacuation plans. These are the plans that are in the lobby of public buildings, usually near the elevators, that tell you where you are and where's the nearest exit. People with low vision have had problems with them. And right now, the state of California, specifically the state fire marshal's office, is revamping these. And Sharon Toji will be with one of her staff people will be there to, asking for people's input. It'll be about 15 to 20 minutes of your time, and then you're going to be put into your name will be put into a drawing for not a quiet car. But it's IPOX shuffle. Yeah. Thank you. Which plays music and I guess audio CDs of some sort. I'm sorry. Also, she's going to have some new tactile signs that people who are interested or totally blind to check them out, and their names will be put into a drawing where you would receive signs that you could donate to some business that are for restrooms. That would be the whole setup for restrooms. So there, it's 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. tomorrow only, and you would go into the Santa Cruz room. We'll have this announcement made throughout the this afternoon and this evening. There's no right or wrong answers to anything. It's just getting your personal opinion, what works or what doesn't work for you. So thank you very much on that. Do we have our vendors here yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, Rob. And the other two? Nancy? And Bob? Bob from Plur? Okay, good. No, different Bob. Okay. What I want to do right now is have three different vendors here that are exhibiting. to talk a little bit about their product and to answer questions you might have. And very few. Just they're, each one is going to get about 10 minutes, and then they'll tell you where they're located so you can talk to them more in depth. First, I would like... I apologize. I said Bob, and it was Ken, isn't it? Ken. Hoover? Howard. Okay, from Western Pacific Signage. Signals? Yeah, I really got this back. Polara Engineering, he's representing. I apologize, Bob. Ken?
Okay. Please.
Thank you. No disrespect. Not a problem.
I am Ken Hauer. I'm from Western Pacific Signal, and we're here showing the Polara products today. Oh, how about that? There we go. We're here showing the Polara products. Polara product, what we're doing is trying to come up with a informational signal that's going to give everyone the same information that the sighted people have. What the Navigator is an informational giving device for pedestrian signal crosswalks for a signalized intersection. And what it does is it gives you the vibral, tactile, and audible information along with a raised vibrating arrow that points in the direction that you're to cross. This gives you pretty much 100% of the information that most sighted people have, so it makes it pretty safe for you guys to cross. We're over at table one. It's the very first table when you go into the room. It's on the left-hand side when you're going through the door. And if anybody would like to come over, we can give you a full demonstration on it, give you some information, whether it be in Braille or large print, what the Navigator is, what it does. And I've also got some forms over there to request from the cities if they would like to try to get those put in the city. I know it's a little tough to do that at this particular point, but this letter does help quite a bit. Does anybody have any questions possibly on the Navigators as to what they are, what they can do for you? Yes.
In terms of cost, for fact, we're going on Tuesday morning because we requested an audible signal, and we have the beep and chirp technology. So what I'm wondering is comparison cost of, I understand, you know, we want the most we can get, and I really like that, but what our city council is going to say is what's the cost. So I'm looking at cost comparison.
Cost-wise, when it comes to the standard cuckoo, peep-peep, chirp type one, they are a little more money because not only do we provide the cuckoo and the peep-peep, but we also provide a voice direction or just a standard direction along with the tactile vibrating button. You're looking at, for a full intersection, that's 8 buttons, and you may not be talking a full intersection here, but for a full intersection, there it's about $5,500, and that is for the equipment that does not include the installation. The city would have to have a contractor install it, of which the two-wire system is very easy because it just pretty much replaces the standard buttons that are there. There is also one available for the island as well. The way that the Navigator two-wire works is you're allowed to have 3 buttons per phase, and a phase is a crossing. So what that does is gives you each side of the street and a center island. Anybody else?
Any other questions? Walking around, actually, I had a question, and you might have just answered it when I was walking to look for folks, but you are able to also cover diagonal intersections?
Yes, actually, I'm just now doing one down in San Diego. San Diego has the intersection of 5th and Market, which they've got running as a normal intersection and a scramble intersection at the same time. So it's pretty challenging on this one, but we think we've got it down pat to where it's going to work just fine.
Not that I'm advocating for those, but it's under the premise of they probably won't go away, so let's figure out how to deal with them.
Well, we're definitely working hard at it. This is going to be the first one that I've done, so we'll find out how well it works.
I believe this one also was done in San Francisco with the structure negotiations. One of the intersection
We've been doing the scramble intersection in San Diego for a couple of years, and it's been working really well. But what they want to do is they want to add the standard crossing as well. So when the normal traffic comes up, that you can do that crossing as well as the scramble crossing at the end of the phase. So that's where the challenge came in, is trying to do both of them at the same time. Anybody else?
Any other questions? I see a hand.
How does it compare price-wise to the standard button that they put in? I mean, that has to cost quite a bit, too. So is there a great difference?
If you talk about just the standard button, the standard ADA button, which is a 2-inch button, which does nothing more than just place a ped call, yeah, there is a considerable difference in the price. Those buttons range anywhere from probably $125 to $150 for the framework and the button, as opposed to what the navigator is. The navigator replaces that entire framework and button assembly because it needs to have a speaker, the vibrator, all that built into it. So they're actually getting quite a bit for their money. They're getting all new buttons throughout the entire intersection, ones that are much more durable than the standard button. Our buttons are rated at over 400 million actuations. That's quite a few. So the chances are is they're not going to break in the life of the button. So they're getting a lot for their money. Plus, they're actually making sure that their intersection is compliant to the ADA rules and regulations.
One more question, and we'll have to move on.
I'm not seeing any hands. That might be everybody.
Thank you very much. Yep.
Thank you. And I apologize. Okay, I have my Braille cards now. Okay, our next would be NaviTech, and we asked Rob Cook. Yes, Bernice?
Oh, go ahead. I was just looking for a card.
Oh, no, I don't have a card here. Rob Cook, if you could, do you have a microphone, Rob?
I think I'm here.
Okay.
Okay, I'm Rob Cook. I am one of you. I came into CCB in 1988, and I've never unjoined. I've lived in 16 other states, from Alaska to Michigan. Now I've been working for Systems for the Blind in various areas, agencies, VA, VR, and I started an independent living center in Oregon. In Eugene, and we moved to Springfield. My wife, who's also a rehab teacher, she's low vision, I'm total. And I met a guy named Kevin Stockton. And Kevin did something that many of us would like to have done, but it was in the midst of the 11:30 hour with the ADA controversies over detectable warnings, truncated domes, what should be, what shouldn't be. But one thing that, this is my personal feeling, Kevin, that really never was addressed directly, loudly, or adequately was a designate standard for wayfinding, or what I call directionality at the intersections. The premise was to alert or warn people. But really, my opinion is, as a totally blind traveler who's been all over the world and in other countries, what happened to directionality? If you've got bumps, why do you need bumps? A truncated dome is 3/8 of an inch elevated off a subsurface, which in a lot of circumstances would be a barrier. Whereas a linear guide that was detectable is not an extraneous object. They can be secured to the pavement just like the markers on the freeways. And that's where Kevin Stockton started with a company called Blind Signs. Now, Kevin passed away. The company is in just a very bad situation with IRS and other things, this patent mix-up. I extricated myself with Gene virtually standing there last year and Mitch, and they said, God, Rob, you know, you were Blind Signs. I mean, and I said, no, I'll try something myself. I was in the midst of patent negotiations with another product that has to do with techno-sensory stuff, but I looked at the simplicity of Kevin's design, and then I thought, now wait a minute. Why would you want a smooth, rounded surface and not have demarcations for linear direction? So I got an engineer buddy. We put it together. I did 6-8 prototypes, worked it through. Well, on May 15th of this year, I filed a provisional patent, and I almost by 2 days made it to the Spring Convention in Sacramento. But the big problem right now is not the product. It's that we're in the middle of a petroleum plastics patent buyout rush. So I have, across the hall, what I call my TPO plate markers. And what these are is they're exact mold models of what I call Navitec DGM. End of that part of this story, the preliminaries, which was Kevin Stockton, newly blind, looked down one day and went, dang, they got liquor store signs. They got everything from stop signs. Why don't they have a blind sign on the pavement so you can find out where you're going? And it's so simple. I went, whoa, this is the next generation. Kevin's passed on. There's no one left in blind signs that's blind. I can speak to that issue because I am now the co-owner with my wife, Cora, of a company that came from us. We are the blind authorities. Because if you don't have directionality, whether you're low vision, a cane user, a guide dog, developmentally disabled, what the good is stopping and being warned? Because now you're left to what? So if you have in conjunction with other devices, a real good example is the APDs, and I love Polara and Navigator. But if you have an intersection like, let's take Shattuck and Center in Berkeley, or Orange Thorpe in L.A., right? And you've got an APD there. How far is the APD faceplate that is directionally advantageous? How far is it from the edge or entrance to the crosswalk? Well, being myself totally blind, I wouldn't know. And I just have to trust to follow the faceplate along, and I might be 3, 8, 10 feet into, you know, the intersection or out of the intersection one way or the other. With the cost of these guys at $20 a piece on the pavement, you line four up in a row, you can do a whole 4x4 intersection for just a little over $1,300. And what you got is a tactile, detectable, directional guide at the exact entrance of the crosswalk. So as you can understand, in that crosswalk environment, you could walk over, find the locator beacon, you know, with your hearing, find it with your thing. Now you know the general direction with the arrow on the vibrotactile, you know, arrow. And you walk back, find your cane and your marker with these guys. They're plastic. They're on the ground, and they clack because they're hollow. There's a section inside that's hollow. So you don't just go clunk, clunk, and hope for it. You hear them with your cane. You can feel them underfoot. There are 271 colors available. And I'm hoping that on January 1st, all this patent Bologna falls out of the wind. And I can actually get the patent. Because Houston, New York, let's see, Jacksonville, Seattle, Portland Airport. A lot of big places, both of us cities I live in, Eugene, Springfield, they all want to purchase them, as do several of the guide dog schools, Leader Dogs and Seeing Eye. And it's a good product because it came from the troops, you know. Here's a guy that lost his eyesight, Kevin. He just went like, duh, why don't they have this? Well, they didn't want it on the Access Committee, and now the two people on the Access Committee are getting ready to retire, and they're starting to promulgate some money for detectable directional guidance systems in roundabouts. And I am first on the list with Navitec. So I'll take any questions. They're very easy. They're little strips. They're across the way, and I have no idea what table number I am, but I'm directly across and to the right. My markers are 3 inches wide. One has an elevated line on it, 3/8 of an inch wide, and the other has a suppressed or depressed line. And that would be for, like, imagine in an airport, if you're trying to stretch across an area, you don't want to block wheelchairs, carts, or anything else. So the basic premise is to be the least impact with the highest detectability. So that's me.
Any questions?
Raj.
Yeah, I'm going to cough into the mic. I hope you'll all enjoy that.
Is that Rob?
Actually, I just want to ask, I just read about Rob getting attacked on the street in Eugene, and I want to ask how he is.
Well, I still got stitches. I got a big hole in my head right now. That's kind of typical for me. It was a random attack. I'm okay. I had 2 cerebral hemorrhages, 10 stitches, a lot of goody stuff. I got a few more gray hairs. And they know who the guy is. And he was just a wired up on crank street punk. And, you know, his friend was laying on the ground, and I came by with my cane. It was right after the Biden-Palin debate, and I was walking towards the bus, and this guy hassled me, and all I said was, come on, man, you know, get a life. I mean, I'm sure you can find somebody that's more hassle than me with a cane walking down the street. And I walked around him, and that's the last thing I remember. You know, and I was in the hospital for 3 or 4 days, and luckily, Cora, my wife, and everybody took really good care of me. I had a friend actually stay with me because I was so dizzy I needed a walker for 3 weeks, 2 weeks. But I'm okay now. This is my second convention in a week, so, you know, I'm hanging. But I appreciate your concern. I think that's Roger, right? Okay, Roger. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Rob, this is Dave Jackson. I had a question. Okay, so when this buyout is all squared away and you're ready to rock and roll, have you gotten, you've approached various municipalities, I would imagine, the DPWs, the Department of Works, the Department of Transportation.
Mm-hmm.
What has their response been?
Well, right now, I really have hesitated to get into some real serious. When I went to ACB and Blinded Vets National, the people who were there approached me. So I take their names, I've got their information, we've traded information. Everybody likes the concept. They particularly like that it's less cost to do an intersection than the paint for the crosswalk, you know, which is pretty amazing. And these things will have like a 60-year life because you don't have any elevated things to break off or jam on, and they're secured to the pavement with the same epoxy that they use in those departments. About 5 years ago, I talked to Aaron Noble and Michael Mankin, who's California's access guys in Caltrans. They're the most stringent. So what I'm trying to do is when the plastics come through and I fill out, you know, the half dozen or more orders that I have, these 70 different people, I would like to take them, finish out my website with realistic pictures, you know, and the PowerPoint, and send those to people, and then follow up with a physical presentation, just like right now, so they can actually see, feel, and understand it. Because no matter what, no matter how simple the product is, hey, something in hand is worth 1,000 pictures, you know, and it's the truth, because I went through this a lot with blind signs. People couldn't quite get it. And I showed these, people get it, because there's highly elevated and highly suppressed detectable marks, lines on them, so they understand it. And as far as I've checked out, between Western Michigan University, Beasy's been pretty helpful, Beasy Benson on the Access Committee. And, of course, that's because she wants to do research. But my reputation has, you know, been pretty much out there in the forefront, especially after the Access Committee comments in 2003. And it's time for a product like this. And I think that they're just going to have to back down and start paying attention to directionality. Not tear up the pavement, not take a diamond plate groove across the street. Just put the darn things in compliance with, you know, O&M philosophy. Put them at the beginning and entrance of crosswalks. Demarcate transit stops. You can use them as a linear guide on campuses to the disabled students, wherever you would like. And there is no ADA in compliance whatsoever with these. And the remedy to that will happen in March, when I'm going to take these guys and request nationwide equal facilitation.
We ran out of 10 minutes.
That's good.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask a question.
Come across the way.
There's a team across the hall.
Okay.
Rob's going to be here the whole weekend.
You bet.
Take them out.
Yeah. And thank you, guys. Here you go.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our next speaker will be Nancy Hadley, who is the Western Regional Manager of Access Products, to do part of Engineer Plastics. And the area that she's talking about is Echo Glow, stair striping material, but her company also, as I think she'll briefly touch upon, deals with detectable warnings and directional surfaces. Nancy?
Thank you, Gene. Thank you for inviting me. Good morning, everybody. Gene gave me a great introduction there. So thank you, Gene. Yes, I'm with Engineer Plastics. A lot of you are probably familiar with our one product, Armor Tile, and we do have representatives with that today. We're actually over in the Hollywood room and have that product on display as well as our directional tiles. But what I'd like to talk to you about this morning is our EcoGlow. Engineered Plastics and Access Products now has the North American rights to sell this product and manufacture it in the United States. It's actually originated out of New Zealand and has been a product that has been out there for about 10 years. It's a wonderful product offering. It has developed advanced technology for the production of highly visible photoluminescent and anti-slip step edge and path marking solutions. This provides for the safe and efficient movement of people 24 hours a day. We offer stair nosings, handrail markers, pathway markers, signage, aisle markers, and seat numbering and signage as well. The photoluminescent technology can be used to meet emergency lighting requirements. And you have some states that have actually put this into code, like New York City and the state of New York now, where this can be an alternate. And in the international codes next year for 2009, it will be an alternate to an electrical source. So it's, we can promote that it's a green product as well. It's fail-safe, it operates immediately, and it's very easy to maintain. And the lifespan, even outdoors, can be up to 30 years. So and we've pretty well tested it through any type of element, any type of weather, any kind of condition that it will run into, salt, things like that, that are put down on walkways during the wintertime and areas. It's like I said, it's environmentally friendly. It's non-radioactive and non-toxic. Everybody thinks that when they see that photoluminescent material illuminating, they think that it's a radioactive material, but it's not. It's completely safe. So, also, what makes our product unique is that we do put a UV pigment into that photoluminescence before it's actually baked onto the aluminum, so that it protects and it will. That's what helps the lifespan to be 30 years. There's some products out there that actually spray it on after it's been baked onto the aluminum, and ours actually is mixed in there. So it does make it unique, and we do have a patent on that. In any situation, emergency situation, having this to help guide you out of there is, you know, it's just a tremendous safety item to have. Unfortunately, when the Twin Tower episode happened, incident back in, they did have photoluminescent striping on the stairs, and the people that did safely exit that building said that one of the things that really helped them get out of there was the fact that that helped them guide themselves out of the building, and then not only out of the building, but it helped the firefighters go back into the building, too. Once it is illuminated either by natural sunlight or by metal halide fluorescent light in an emergency exit area, it can last up to 5 hours or longer depending on how it was charged. But definitely up to 90 minutes, which is the normal amount of time that it usually takes people to exit out of a high-rise building. Also, even if you do have some emergency lighting that you usually have at the end of each stairwell, you do have shadowing effect with those. And this product helps in that step edge or on the handrail prevent the shadowing effect when they're exiting the building. And we're using a lot of stadiums as well for performances in the evening when people arrive late or if they have to exit during the performance. This helps guide them out of in and out of their seats. So any other questions? That's about it, Gene. I have some of the product there. I have some little samples, too, if you want to take them home and you know, see them. Yes, she's already been to my table. She has her sample there. And Also, we have some of the other products from Engineered Plastics that you can look at as well at our table.
Where is the table?
It's in the Hollywood room, in the back there. I'm actually next to, I'm trying to think of the coffee, right by there, and back of the room there in the Hollywood. Any other questions?
Any questions?
Yes, sir.
Okay, where are you?
Come on up here.
Over
here. Basically, my question would be this. My name is Braden Hover from High Desert. Is this preformed items to be placed, or is it a laminate that can be used and cut and shaped at an install in homes or anywhere like that?
We have some standard strips available, but it's all the anti-skid material is baked. It's baked onto the aluminum.
So it's preformed.
Right, but we are.
So is there
mainly
a way
for step edge and then for our handrails? Yes. Those are preformed for the handrails, and that's just strictly the photoluminescent material.
And is it epoxied to the surface, glued?
You glue it down, yes.
Okay.
And then for carpeted areas, we make those strips. We, you know, special order for theaters and things that where it goes over carpet.
So I could do it as a consumer. I could actually give you the measurements. You could make it for me.
Definitely.
I can order it.
You can go onto our website and order it.
I see.
Yes.
Okay,
there is consumer pricing on the website. And, I put it in my garage just because, stepping in and out of the garage is a great, addition to have. And so when I'm coming in and it's dark and for some reason my lights didn't go on or anything like that, I've got that extra protection there to get me into the house. So it is a great item for even just a regular consumer to have in their home. Thank you for the question.
We got about time for one more question.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Any other? Where are you? I'm coming over.
Okay.
There you go.
The question I have is, and I know that you can't answer this specifically today, but maybe you can take this back to the company, mm-hmm. is would it be possible for you to incorporate tactile features into the product, because we just heard from Mr. Cook about his product, and it would seem to me that your product could also be more valuable with additional tactile features, so that not only would it have the visual qualities of making things easier to see for people with limited vision, but by adding some kind of a tactile feel to it that people could pick up with canes, and it
right.
could also be used for that.
Right. We actually have some samples of that where we've incorporated it with our armor tile and our directional tiles as well. So
oh, good.
That
I'll have
for,
to check it out.
Right. So on it's especially great for transit stations, train stations, things like that. You have a lot of areas like that at night that can be very dark too. So we have incorporated that and have some instances where we are doing that with our tiles. That was a great question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's all the of this portion. And I'm going to go and look at all three tables later on today. So thank you very much. Now, if Donna Pomerantz could come to the front, I've asked Donna to introduce our next speaker, who she's worked with on various projects. And
I'm here.
You're there. Okay, Donna.
I'm everywhere. Okay, our next speaker, his name is Mr. Chip Hazen, and he's the ADA Compliance Administrator or Compliance Officer for the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transit Authority. A number of different accomplishments that he's had. I'm reading this piece of paper about a gentleman that I've worked with for a number of years, and it's interesting to read one's bio, but he's worked for 20 years in transportation planning and management. and administration experience. Chip worked for two nonprofit organizations, and he did nearly 10 years at the Braille Institute here in Los Angeles, working on their transportation program. He also was project manager for establishing what is now called the Access Paratransit. And he worked to get that started. He was on the ground of forming that here in Los Angeles. He chaired the Los Angeles County Transportation Commission's, which later became Metro Elderly and Disabled Advisory Committee. Chip was very instrumental in developing the countywide Los Angeles County Transportation Operators Association's LACTOA Disabled Identification Card. So as a result of this card, we are able to ride other fixed route lines that operate throughout the county. Los Angeles County is a pretty large county, so that definitely is a wonderful accomplishment. We can also ride the trains and the light rail, Gold Line and Red Line, and the different lines that we have out here as a result of that. There are a number of other accomplishments that Mr. Hazen has here on his biography, but I want to let you know, as a member of Metro's Accessibility Advisory Committee, who does sensitivity trainings with Mr. Hazen, Chip, for bus operators, staffs, and there he goes. Him and Mitch are probably heckling me out there. I heard him laughing. It truly is an honor to work with a man like this who actually wants to hear what we have to say and works with us to try and find the solutions to the problems and barriers that we find in our transportation system here in L.A. County. So he's definitely a man I've enjoyed working with and will continue to work with, whether he wants me to or not, because I'm not going away. And I've learned a great deal from Chip, and I am very, very proud to introduce Mr. Chip Hazen, and I'm very happy he's here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. I'll give you your paycheck next week if it's okay with you. Wow, what an honor to be here. This is really someplace, a nice location. But I really do like the how they tell you where the elevator buttons are, because they put the trash can right in front of the elevator button. Yeah, my comment to Mitch was, yeah, it must have been trained by Metro. You got to have a sense of humor doing what it is that we all do, because if you don't, it just isn't going to work. So thank you very much for inviting me here. When Donna said that she'd like me to talk about Metro a little bit, I said, good, I got a great PowerPoint presentation. She said, you can't use it. I don't know what her problem is. No, actually, I have a little bit of experience working with people with vision impairments. For 10 years, I spent running Braille Institute's transportation program, including Palm Springs, L.A., Orange County, and Ventura County programs. So I got to see all the different systems and got to work with them and help design their programs to bring them into the line that the executive director wanted, which was cheaper and required you to walk someplace. Well, we won't go into that one. Basically, I also run two city dial-a-ride programs, and as Donna tried to get away with, I did help design what we call Metro Access in Los Angeles, and there were four of us that designed it back in the 90s, and right now I have nothing whatsoever to do with it. So what they do is up to them. The only time I get involved is if there's an ADA compliance issue. So if somebody has feels that they are have been violated, that their civil rights were violated, then I get involved with it. Other than that, I really don't. If the FTA comes out and inspects them, then I get involved with the meeting. And if there's a lawsuit, then I get involved with it. So other than that, I don't have a whole lot to do with access, because we have two people. One person sits on their board for Metro, and we have another full-time person who handles all the access services programs. So she handles the contract, makes sure that they get paid. She makes sure that things go right. If somebody has an issue or a problem, it goes to her. Then she works with them. So that way I don't have to, and I can concentrate more on what Metro does or doesn't do, depending on how it is that you look at it. I also have a very charming wife of 33 years, and she teaches kids who are blind for San Bernardino County Superintendent of Schools at a high school. So she has kids who are from 7th grade to 12th grade in her class right now. And the biggest thing that she enjoys is when some of them come back, some of her alumni come back, and to visit her. And her last one was last year he came back. He just finished his master's degree. He's totally blind. He works for the civil... civil aeronautics people, and he said it's great to fly a plane, but landing's a little bit tough. So they'll let him fly it, but they won't let him land it. I do have a little bit of education. I have an undergraduate degree in speech pathology and audiology, which means I know enough to say hi and then go, huh? Say it again? Can't quite hear you. And then I also have this other thing called a master's in public administration. So I've done a little bit of that type of stuff with education things, you know, but it's not easy. I don't like doing education things. It's much more fun to go out and work with people. So Donna asked me to speak on some things that are new and innovative programs to Metro and what we are doing to assist people with vision impairments in riding our buses and our trains. So I've got about 7 pages here, so if you just pardon me and sit back and relax, we'll go through this. And then we're going to do a question and answer period. Okay, that's when the test comes in to find out if I really know what it is I'm talking about. And the only thing that I will not answer is, why do the drivers do? Because I have no idea why they do what they do. Yeah, you know, they seem to have their mind of their own, and they whatever it is, it doesn't work for somebody. That's the way that they want to do it. Fortunately, though, we have a lot of excellent drivers, just fantastic people. But we still have that 10% of operators, you know, that just don't do what it is they should be doing. Unfortunately, that 10% represents 500 people. So that's 500 operators, and those are full-time operators, which means the chances of you getting a full-time operator who has a problem is probably fair to, you know, you might get someone who's just having a bad day, but you might get an operator that really doesn't really care. And those are the ones that we're trying to identify and we're trying to get rid of through some way or another. So one of the things that the first thing that I did when I started Metro, I came back to Metro in 2003. In 1997, they decided they didn't need me anymore, so they eliminated me and 650 other people. And in 2003, I came back as the ADA compliance officer. And one of the things that only took 3.5 years to do, and that's to change the policies for the bus operators. You know, it's really hard to do things when you're looking at rules that were made in 1995. And, yeah, they complied with the ADA, but, you know, they really didn't have the language that was correct. They didn't have the things, the knowledge that we have now. So we went through and we redid that. We're also working on our website, trying to make it accessible. What a concept, huh? Why? Accessible to people so they can actually know what it is, or, you know, so that it reads to them. So we're trying to do that. We have a transportation passenger information system in our rail lines. We have 4 rail lines, and we're working on putting that thing in. And we have a bus automatic annunciator, which calls stops in all of our buses when it works. We're also working on a concept of between-the-car barrier for our rail system. New developments, we have a gold line. We're going to be installing the passenger information system on. And we're opening up a rail line to East Los Angeles in June of 2009. And we have a line that we're in the process of building along Exposition Boulevard that will open up in 2010. When I came back from Metro in 2003, I noticed something. When I had left in 97, ADA was considered a four-letter word. You know, I think people thought that it was a personal affront against them. And that's primarily how it is that they acted about it. And when I came back, it was after a lawsuit that Metro settled on, and the lawsuit had to do with picking up people in wheelchairs, of all things. And when Metro went through and looked to find out how substantial this really was, they determined that only 10% of the buses with lifts, all the buses had lifts, but only 10% of them worked, which 90% did not work. There was one whole division, 450 buses, none of the lifts worked, and no mechanic that knew how to fix them. So that's what it is that I left. And when I came back, it was, no, ADA is very important. In fact, everybody from the bus supervisors all the way up to the CEO knows that ADA must be implemented, ADA must be done, and we will do it. Not an issue of, well, let's debate this thing. You know, why do we have to do it this way? Well, actually, what I do is when somebody does say that to me, I tell them why we have to do it that way. Tell them that, you know, it's done this way so that these people can do this, you know, X, Y, and Z. And they go, oh, well, that makes sense. So I don't know if it's true or not, but that's part of what my job is to educate people. So at Metro, I'm trying to educate them as much as possible. It was really neat the other day, sitting in a meeting, talking about between car barriers, and this one guy came in and said, I have the whole answer. All we have to do is just train these people so that they don't fall off the platform. You know, we'll put this stuff on the platform so when they walk over it, they'll know where they are, and they won't fall off the platform. And another person turned over to him and said, it won't work. And then he told him why. And, you know, that to me, that was very, very important because it meant that I had been working with these people, telling them what it is that they need to do. I mean, why it is that we're doing these things. And then he comes right back and tells this other guy, who is our lead architect at the agency, and telling him why it is that his idea won't work, which was cool. It was great. And then he shut up and he sat down and he listened to the rest of the meeting. So it was really good. One of the big things that I use, that Donna said, is my advisory committee. And I call it my advisory committee because I think it is mine, but it's actually Metro's. But I take some ownership in it because I think the people on the advisory committee are great. I can call them and I can ask them an opinion, and they'll always give me an opinion. Meaning not be the opinion I want. But or the right one. But that's the reason why we have different people on the committee. One thing that, and Don and I keep talking about this, I don't want somebody who's going to be a yes person. I don't want somebody to come in and say, yeah, oh, that's perfect. Oh, let's do it that way. Heck, I could do that simply. You know, I don't even need you to tell me, yes, we can do it. We can just go ahead and do it. No, I'd rather listen to what it is that they say, and then that way we can implement something that's going to work for everybody or as many people as possible. So that's very important to me. The committee is very important to me. We're working on a lot of different issues. And something that Donna and the committee, actually the committee does not know, we have a new training person, director of our bus operators training group. He wants to use the advisory committee members to come in and help teach the sensitivity class. And we just haven't implemented that part yet within the committee, but we're going to real soon. And it's just, I think it's something that's very, very needed. When I worked at Braille Institute back in the 70s and 80s, I took that concept because I also sit on at that time, the RTD, which is a forerunner to Metro, the RTD board, or RTD advisory committee, and said, you know, we need to have people out here who actually knows what it's like to have a disability and talking to your bus operators. So we put that program in. And over the years, it fell out. So now we're going to put it back in. And I think it's very, very needed. So a little bit about who is Metro. You know, how big is Metro? It's basically the second largest public transportation operator in the United States. Right behind New York. A long way behind New York. New York has 45,000 employees. We have 10,000. So New York is huge. But we're about the same size as Chicago and New Jersey. We deploy 2,261 buses during our peak time in the morning. You want to get an idea how many buses that is? It's a lot. Trust me. Okay, most operators have a total of 500 buses. Those are the fairly large ones. And you, basically, you go with the 2,000 buses like what we have. Actually, we have 2,700. And you go with you know, New Jersey and Chicago and ourselves, you know, with these big numbers. Then the next group that comes under that is 1,000 buses. And then the next group is 750 buses. And even the top 100 of the top 100 systems in the United States, the number 100 only has, they have less than 100 buses. So you're talking about, there's not a whole lot of huge systems out there. Well, Metro is one of them. So we're one of the biggies. We transport 1.5 million people a day. That's a lot of people that get onto our buses and trains. And that number does not include the rideshare programs that we administer, the special programs such as what we call the immediate needs transportation program, which is coupons and bus tokens for people to who need a trip right now, right today. It doesn't include the ADA paratransit service. They transport between 7,000 to 9,000 people a day in Los Angeles County. And it doesn't include our 14 contracted bus lines. So of our 230 lines, 14 of them are contracted. So we require them to do everything it is that we require bus operators, but we actually make them do it. Well, we try to. We have 16,000 bus stops, and we cover a square mile area of about 1,200 square miles. Now, Los Angeles County is 4,400 square miles, 4,423 square miles, and we provide about one-third of that, service in one-third of that. And that's primarily where the majority of the people in Los Angeles live. You got 9.5 million people that live in this 1,200 square mile area. It's a little bit larger than that. And 500,000 people that live in the rest of the county. But the rest of the county is mountains and desert. So those areas are growing, but not quite as big as others. Metro employees, I told you we have 10,000 employees, but we also have 4,500 bus and rail operators. Okay, so when I say that we have 10% of our operators, you know, each business you figure, okay, 10% of the employees are no good. Well, that means we still got 450 operators out there that are not really good. So if you look at it that way, it changes things a little bit differently. Just like access services, if you look at that, they do 7,000 trips a day. 10% of those trips are outside. They pick up people outside of their 20-minute window. That's 700 trips. That's a lot of trips. When I run the transportation program for the city of Burbank, we only did 350 trips a day. Metro, twice that, is having problems with twice that many trips that we provided. So you have to look at things in the economy of scale. We contract on 14 lines, and that mostly covers our smaller type buses, our locations where we don't have a bus yard that's real close to where it is that those buses run. And basically it costs us about $80 an hour to contract for those lines, and if we operated it, it would cost us about $120 to operate it. So for that other $40 that we save, then we put that back into service for other services in other locations. So what's new on Metro Bus Service? One of the things is that we're looking at right now is securing wheelchairs. We're going to require that all wheelchairs be secured. In order to do that, you know, because wheelchairs are a little bit different, they're all different actually, where it's really hard to tell where it is to secure them. So we're going to put what we call a marking on it, something for the bus operators can figure out where to put to attach the hook on the bus, from the bus. And then if we can't find a place to put that onto the wheelchair, then we're going to put a tether strap, which is a nylon strap that's anywhere from 11 to 20 inches long, and the bus operator can attach the hook to that strap. Basically, the reason why we're doing that is for safety. Safety of the people in the wheelchair, but also safety of everybody else in the bus. Because if the bus stops suddenly, the wheelchair does not. And the wheelchair would just go wherever it is that the wheelchair wants to go. And you think that rubber on rubber stops things? No, not at all. Okay, so those rubber tires on a rubber mat won't stop anything. So that thing's just going to keep sliding wherever it is that it wants to go. You know, no matter how good the brakes are on the wheelchair. So we're going to start securing it, making sure that's safe for everybody. The automatic vehicle annunciator system, which is something I think that you might be interested in. Our policy is to call out every stop using that system. And to the most part, we do. We do have stops, though, that are really, really short in distance, basically the halfway point in between a block. So we will call out two or three stops all at one time. The problem that you might have is when we do it that way, we may have to stop three or four times in between those stops. So it might get a little bit confusing for you. Okay, we have some operators, too, that don't quite understand our policies and rules for exiting the bus. And because we have the announcement that says, please use the rear door. Some operators believe that that is gospel. You have to use the rear door. That's for people who don't have any physical disabilities. And if they can, they should use the rear door. If you can, that'd be great. If not, then the front door is fine. So we're trying to get our operators educated to that. We still have one or two complaints a month that comes in on that. But we're getting a lot better. We used to have 6 and 7 and 8 complaints a month. Now we're down to 1 or 2. So we're getting a little bit better on it. If the AVA, the automatic vehicle annunciator system, does not work, then the operator is still required to call out the stops, such as major intersections, transfer points with other bus lines, requested stops, and the best one of all, whatever it takes to orientate the customer to their location. You know that that's a requirement? You know, the question is, what does that mean? You know, what do you need in order to orientate you? So our only answer that we've come back with is all the bus stops. Okay, so we call out all the bus stops. So that's why where that requirement came from. And bus operators must use the PA system if it's working. Now, a lot of them will say it doesn't work. That's because they don't understand. The PA system itself will cut off after 30 seconds. And no matter how long they hold that button down, after 30 seconds, it will stop. That's a built-in safety feature for the device, and so that it doesn't burn up by an operator continually talking on the PA system or holding the button down continuously. So after 30 seconds, they have to release the button, push it back again, and then they can continue to talk. Talking into it? What was my rule? What's my rule? I can't tell you why the operators do things that they do. But we are teaching them how to speak into a microphone.
Now, if you notice, I'm a little bit close here.
Yeah. So you don't want to be that close to a microphone so that then it comes across like, right? Okay, like some operators do. Our train is like that, some of them. So we don't want them to do that, so we want to hold it just a little bit away from their mouth so that it doesn't pop like this one does. It's up just a little bit too high, but that's okay. We won't tell them that. We also have the things that I have here. I have a few of them that I brought, which are called... The first one I want to talk about is a map. And this map is tactile. It is in Braille. And we can pass it out. And I have a few of them, and some of you can keep them if you'd like. The rest of you can't have them. Or if you want them, you need to call a telephone number, and I'll give you that in a second here. And the maps are used as of our Braille systems. I'm sorry, our rail system, so that you know where it is that you want to go to on our rail, where the stops are and where the transfer points are on the rail. So we put that together with what we call a travel kit. And Donna's going to pass it around. If you don't want to keep it, just please pass it on to somebody else next to you so that everybody in the room can take a look at them. And the map is interesting because you can do a number of different things with it. If you unfold it, it comes out really nice. The other thing that we have is what we call flashcards. And these flashcards is a book of cards consisting of three numbers. And the three numbers are in, they're tactile and they're in Braille. and they're quite large, so that if you hold them up toward, you know, a little bit above your head at a bus stop that is that has more than one bus lines that service that stop. As an example, in West Hollywood, we have one line that has 26 bus lines that serves that stop. So, which may take a little while, and your bus may be somewhere in the queue, somewhere back there. So, if just pass that to your left, sir. Yeah, Mitch, reach out your hand there. Okay. So the flashcards are used so that the bus operator knows that you're looking for a particular bus route. And when he sees the flashcards, or she, they will get onto the external speaker. All the buses have external speakers. And they will say, "That is, you know, this is route number 322, come forward." Okay, and so basically they'll direct him over to the bus. And this actually does work. I was told the other day that the person tried it and it worked without any problem whatsoever. So most bus operators do recognize this program and understand it. And it is helpful. We also have in there cards or things for a taxi, so you can hold a taxi up, or for access. If you want a copy of this, I can give you the phone number that you can call for this if you'd like it. The number is 213. Well, get your piece of paper out. 213-922-7023. And I'll tell you that at the end of my presentation as well. Again, it's 213-922-7023.
And actually, what I would tell everybody is the flashcards that are being passed around, open them up. It's okay. Because that's the only way you can really experience those flashcards. Because they're wrapped in plastic. So open them up. I'll finish passing out more.
Take that plastic, rip it off, and throw it away in the trash can when you leave. That'd be great. No problem whatsoever. You know, I didn't bring these things down here to take them back to my office with me. Trust me. The other thing we're doing is that we're replacing all of our buses. Some of our buses that are still out there were built back in 1982. Our 1980 buses, which we retired this summer, are slowly being replaced. So some of those are the buses with the lifts that are in the rear. It makes it real interesting trying to meet the ADA requirements with that. We are restructuring our bus lines. Believe it or not, some of our bus lines were determined in 1885. Metro is a descendant of the former rail corporation that was here. Some of you may have known it as Red Cars or Yellow Cars. Okay, we are the descendant of that agency. So our first rail line was put in 1885. In 1901, we started running buses. So we've been around for a while. We had a gentleman just retired a couple years ago that had been with the agency for 67 years. He missed one day of service, and that was when his wife passed away. And 1 month after he retired, he retired. The next day he turned 100, and a month later he passed away. So he was 100 years old. He is the employee of the century. We're also replacing the head signs in our buses. If you looked at our buses before the head signs, that's where it says what the bus number is and where it's going. It had a 3.5-inch height on it. Now they're going to be 6-inch letters. So they should be a little bit easier to read. We're also trying to do something a little bit different in our buses. And I just came from another meeting talking about San Francisco Muni and some of the things that they weren't doing. They actually have a real good process up there for the priority seating area. So we're going to take some of their language off of their signs, and we're going to apply it to our buses. We're also looking at taking that priority seating area. She'll be back in just a second, ma'am. The priority seating area, we're talking about making that into a certain type of area. So as an example, we may take blue for the flooring and make it the flooring all blue in that area. Blue because that's what our color is for the disabled program. So make that whole area. That would include the two side bench seats and the first forward-facing seat. Okay, so the first forward-facing seat is the seat that will be designated for people with disabilities and seniors, and the side-facing seats will be dedicated for wheelchairs. And we'll put a little sign up there saying, you know, move your blooming body for somebody in a wheelchair. Okay, so we're going to be a little bit more aggressive than what we have been in the past on it, trying to get people to move out of that area so people in wheelchairs can get on. So we're still meeting on that. Nothing's been decided totally yet, but we're still meeting. We're also considering signage that states that riders should vacate the seats in this area for people with seniors, for people with disabilities and seniors. And we're also developing what we call a bus monitoring program. Right now we're using the advisory committee members to report on their trip. And it's electronic report where they will go online and they will... Donna, you had two people up here. The lady in the blue has a question. Lady in the red had a question. The bus monitoring program, basically you would fill out the survey. It's like a mystery shopper survey. You'd fill it out. It covers the ADA issues, the things that we must comply with. And if we do not comply with it, then you are to mark it down, saying that we don't. The operator didn't do what they're supposed to be doing, or they did do what they're supposed to be doing. And then electronically you submit it. And that information we're going to be used. Yes, the lady here in the blue with the walker and the lady in the back with the...
I was actually going to beg somebody because I forgot to give a set to our chair, Jean Lozano. And so if anybody is willing to give up a map and their flashcards to donate to Jean, okay.
Perfect. And you have a question?
No, I want a flashcard.
Oh, see, we ran out of flashcards. And okay. Map? And flashcards? No, just one.
Donna, behind you, there's a gentleman that... Right behind you. There you go.
There you go.
Thank you. And we ran out of flashcards and maps.
And the reason why is because I didn't bring very many because the things are very heavy and I have a very light load that I can carry up 5 pounds yet after my back surgery. So I haven't quite recovered yet from that. Still working on that. The bus monitoring program basically is we're still working on getting the bugs out. Once we get all the bugs out of this program, then we're going to be opening it up to other people that the advisory committees recommend that they would like to become part of this program. So that'll be opening up to most everybody who would want to go through it. What I require, though, is for the people to meet with me. It takes about an hour to an hour and a half and discuss what the ADA requirements are. Because a lot of people have an idea of what the requirements are, but they don't know what our interpretation of the requirements are. So I want to explain that to them. So when they're filling out this form, we're all talking from the same direction, the same information. So as an example, did the operator call out the stop? You know, if the AVA system didn't work, did the operator call out the stop? Did they call out all the stops or just certain stops? They're not required to call all the stops, only certain stops like we went through just a minute ago. Okay, so as a rider, you need to understand that. And if you're reporting that to me, then I need to understand what it is that you're saying. And at the bottom of this thing, there's a little comment section, so you can really tell me what it is that went on. So as an example, Mitch is one of our people who does the surveys. He had an experience on a bus that was really, really positive for him. Okay, it wasn't.
I thought you said, you know, another Mitch. Anyway.
So anyway, at the bottom, Mitch could tell me really what the details were so that we can go back to this operator. We can determine, one, if we want to send that operator to retraining, do we just need to counsel this operator? Or do we need to start looking at this operator, what we call an undercover rider, which means that one of our supervisors will go out and, in Mitch's case, using a white cane because we don't have dogs, but he would use a white cane, take the white cane out there and pretend that he's legally blind and get onto the bus, observe the operator, see what the operator does with a rider like that, and then go from there. And 45% of the time that they've gone out and done this, the operators end up with a reprimand. Okay, so just to let you know, that does happen. Sir, you have a question?
Actually, I have a question back here. I have two questions back here.
Okay.
And then if we could get to the sir, whoever he is.
Okay. Hi, I use one of your contractors, Foothill Transit, and I have two, that is a contractor, right? Okay, I have two questions. One is in regards to the enunciator system. If you could describe a little bit more about how that works. Is that a GPS system or is that within the bus? I've been on the bus where they have turned it on, I believe, when I get on. I'm not sure if it's on before that, but it's doing the opposite route, so it's not effective. The second question has to do when is there a policy regarding the operators and beginning to drive the bus once you've entered the bus? So I enter the bus, and I had one driver who would not wait more than 2 or 3 seconds before starting the bus, even after I asked her to wait a little bit longer so I could sit down. And she said that she's never had that complaint before. But I was wondering if there was a policy regarding that.
Actually, there is, and it's in the next item, the next bullet point that I was going to be talking about. So if I can hold that for a second, let's go back to the AVA question, the Automatic Vehicle Enunciator System. Yes, it is a GPS system where we take a poll of 18 different satellites to determine where it is that the bus is located. We also have to do that. Prior to that, to set it up, we have to go around and insert into onto the software where every bus stop is. And most of the time it works. Occasionally it does not. The system itself is not foolproof. We still have a lot of bugs in it. The system is still under warranty. We're still working through the warranty period. So if you have a problem with a bus and the stops are not being called correctly, running backwards seems to be a big problem because in Los Angeles County there's a lot of potholes. Yeah, probably shouldn't say that. LA City's worse, but we won't tell you that today. And as a result of the potholes, believe it or not, when we go over a pothole, we hit it really well, it knocks this thing crazy. It will reverse it. It will stop. It will go all kinds of different directions. The other thing is that we have not put this into the 14 lines that we contract with. And the reason why, unless it's a newer bus, we are in the process of replacing all those buses. And within the next year and a half to 2 years, all those buses will be replaced that the contractors run. And then, because the buses are normally built back in the 80s, we didn't want to put a $10 million program into a bus. I'm sorry, a $10,000 program into a bus and then have to take it out again in a very short time. So we didn't put it purposely into the contracted lines. But when they get a bus replacement, a new bus replacement, then it will be part of what it is that they're doing. Does that answer your question on that?
And who is the sir up here? Okay, it was Frank.
Right here. You're right.
Okay, and then, all righty.
MTA, I'm sure, touches upon a lot of different bus systems. You have the Foothill Transit, Long Beach, Orange County, Omnitrans, probably Ventura. What's the possibility of maybe MTA helping us out with a statewide ID so that when we register as having a disability, we don't have to carry all these IDs to do work and interact with all these different systems? It's really frustrating because, for instance, I'm in San Bernardino, Highland, going to Riverside. Riverside doesn't really recognize Omnitrans ID, and then opposite with Riverside. I mean, they'll accept you, yes, but they've kind of frowned upon it. But we really need a statewide ID system, and I think MTA could really help us because it touches upon other agencies.
Go ahead, Ian.
Andy.
The CCB did pass several years ago legislation regarding this, and as a result of that, and I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember the citation, but the PUC has in a section stating in their regs that that different transit districts are to recognize each other's CART. And that was because of legislation CCB introduced, and I'm embarrassed to say I cannot recall the citation from the PUC on that.
Yeah, they're required to recognize it. The issue comes in for one system is different agencies use different definitions of what a person with a disability is or what a person who is a senior. So they use different. Some agencies look at 50 years old as a senior, as an example. Some of them, like us, we're at 62. So there's a big difference between those two. Even people with disabilities, Long Beach Transit has a different definition of a disability than what anybody else within the county, because there is a functional disability for the Dollar Ride program. And it's a completely different set of rules that everybody else uses within the county. Culver City has a different set of rules. But with the ID pass that we developed in L.A. County in 1980, that ID pass, we came together and we all agreed on one set of rules. Now, there's disagreement constantly on those sets, you know, and what everybody agreed on. So far, everyone said, okay, fine, we will continue it. About 3 or 4 years ago, Metro wanted to back out of it, because there were people that wanted to change the definition to the point that we could not accept it, because it included too many people getting a lower fare. And it isn't because they had a disability or didn't have a disability. It had to do with another aspect of it. Okay, so to get a statewide card is not going to be the easiest thing to do, because of different definitions.
Okay, I ride the Bus 167, which I believe is another contracted line, and I was wondering if the contracted lines are supposed to meet the same requirements as the regular Metro buses, because for one thing, they use a different kind of bus on that line. I've never seen that bus anywhere else in the system. It's, for one thing, you know, the steps are narrow and steep and almost like serpentine. In fact, the top step, you actually have to turn when you go up the step. And I know that a lot of disabled people have complained that it's funny, because the driver tells me that the buses are equipped for the disabled, and I know there was one woman one time who said, well, if you're not disabled before you get on the bus, you're going to be disabled after you try to get on the bus. Also, I noticed that the drivers seem to be very reluctant to call stops, and I've never seen audible stop announcements on those buses. So I wonder, are those buses supposed to comply with the same regulations that the regular Metro buses do?
Yes, they are. If they do not, we need you to tell us, and then we will follow up with them, and then we will basically tell them that if they don't continue, or if they continue to act this way, then we'll be glad to change contractors. Mm-hmm. We have one contractor that will not not bid with us anymore because we just fined them $50,000. Mm-hmm. Okay, so their contract is ending, and we take it very seriously that they must comply with the requirements. So when the complaint comes in, I get a copy of any accessibility complaint, and we work with whomever it is that needs to be worked with. If it's with our people, I go through what we call our bus operations control unit, and they will contact the division and make sure that the division understands what the requirements are. If it's the contracted services, then we have two supervisors that oversee them, and they constantly go out and talk with them. Don and I did a training with them in August, was it, Donna? Yes, something like August, on sensitivity towards people with disabilities. And the trainers, some of them had never heard some of this stuff before. So it was an interesting discussion in going through with them. And these were the trainers of their operators. So that stuff they're taking back to their operators. As you know, even from Metro, it's going to take a while to get all that information back out there. So in the meantime, tell us, call us, and let us know.
And when it's tell us, call us, that means we need to know the time, we need to know the line, you know, the direction. We have to know all the details so that we can, you know, accurately research it. And, you know, because if we have some fuzzies, then there's nothing we can do. And unfortunately, you'll keep complaining because we can't try to fix it because we don't have the identifier.
We need to know the date, the time, the direction you're going in, the location got onto the bus, and the fifth thing that I can never remember. No, not the number of the vehicle, because, one, there's no way for you to get it if you can't see.
We got race pin and braille signs in Sacramento on our buses.
No, we're working on that. That's our next phase when we do signage on our buses, is to put them in braille and tactile. I'll remember it eventually. Gene, you had something you wanted to say?
Yeah, if it's just, you mentioned earlier about the company starting to phase out some of the buses, get newer buses, and I'm assuming everything I've heard that the New York and LA, to a lesser extent, dictates the design of the buses manufactured, because you buy the most buses.
Because you have
and we are in Sacramento using the Orion low floor vehicles, and those lower floor vehicles are starting to become a problem for persons with disabilities, even though they're supposed to be really accessible. They're pitting, we have in this, and I'm just bringing this out, if you're going to be going toward these type of vehicles, Orions, is that the disabled priority seating is the seating that when a person in a wheelchair comes aboard is the one that is eliminated, and you got disabled people and seniors that are having to be, who need to be up there, are being pushed toward the rear of the bus. And of course, the persons who have mobility devices should be able to get in there. But it's, you're pitting one disability against another disability in the seating there. Also, with those newer bus, low-floor buses, the wheel well area in the front is no longer any, has no seats. And there's, on one side, there's a cabinet behind the driver with all the clever devices, equipment, and so forth. Passengers, not necessarily just able-bodied passengers, now get on those buses and stay in there. Now, it's supposed to be training, you know, please stand back, please move back, or so forth. But people, it's starting to become, throughout our system, a habit where people just cluster there. Sometimes we'll ride about a half a mile to a mile before they get to their stop because they don't want to go to the back. And it's just because of the nature of the way the buses, that you can lean up against the cabin and so forth. And then it's a real challenge for a disabled person or anyone else to try to get on or off the bus, because you have to go through this mob of people. Now, that's training, and we're getting on the training people, an RT in that. But I thought I'd mention that that's an issue, and also the fact that, like, some of the blind want to sit in the priority seat to be close to the driver. Now, when some other disability using mobility device comes aboard, you then sometimes end up in the rear of the bus, and you've lost contact with the driver totally.
Wait till you see our new buses that are 90 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how long it's going to be to get back there. Basically, what Gene is saying is correct.
And also, the last thing is that mm-hmm. some of the companies are starting to go, you know, we've been talking earlier about quiet cars, but there's hybrid buses,
yes.
Other type of devices, even motorcycles that the Sacramento Police Department is using, hybrid motorcycles that are quiet. So,
buses. Yeah, well, our engines are in the rear of the bus, but they're really noisy when they come into a stop. They make a lot of noise, even though the engine's 40 feet away. The seat that Gene's talking about is the flip seats on the side that's opposite the driver, and the forward-facing flip seats. Mm-hmm. When we go through and we design this area for people with disabilities and seniors, that area, those two flip seats will be part of the wheelchair securement area. We're going to have to go on the other side of the bus to the first forward-facing seats that are not part of the securement area for wheelchairs. Because if you look at the ADA regulations, that's part of the wheelchair seating area. So you can't use those seats that flip up. You have to use the opposite seats on the opposite side. So basically, they're not totally compliant with what the ADA says, is what the issue is. Gene?
Will both sides have seats in both sides of the bus, two securement areas?
Then you should be going to the first forward-facing seat that's not part of the securement area, and that's what the law says.
Okay, I have a question.
And that's the reason why we're going to the color-coded, to try to make it a certain area. Yeah, one more question that I need to move along if you want me to cover everything else. Yes.
What is the policy on making sure operators, whether they are metro operators or some of the contractors, in having to turn on the annunciators? I've been on many Foothill buses, which I'll be traveling along, they'll stop and change drivers, and then the new driver will decide not to turn on the annunciator, or they'll reboot the annunciator, and it'll finally be working correctly instead of counting the stops backwards. And that happens a lot.
I can't address other systems, but with Metro, our automatic vehicle annunciator system comes on when you turn the key on, and the operators cannot turn it off. However, they can turn the volume down, and if it's a noisy operating bus, they can turn it down to the point that very few people can really hear it. So Foothill Transit, and we're trying to work through that, but we're a bureaucracy trying to get people to do things. But let me go through the bus operator rulebook changes that we did. Service animals, we expanded on that. So we talk about more what service animals are and how to work with service animals and who they are. Also, there's a requirement that at least two service animals can come onto a vehicle at one time. And we put that into the rule as well. A larger emphasis that the animal may not have anything to do with the current trip purpose, but they may be needed for other reasons at the destination, because some people believe that animal must be used only while the person is traveling. That's not what the law says. We're doing more information on wheelchairs, such as anyone may request for the lift or the ramp if they want to board or disembark a bus. It doesn't have to be somebody in a wheelchair. I took the term wheelchair out. So we call it a ramp or a lift, not a wheelchair ramp or a wheelchair lift. Okay, hoping that the operators will begin to understand that this is more than just wheelchairs. It's for walkers. It's for whatever mobility device that the person may be using. There's also a very strong suggestion that when they spot the bus, now spotting is when you take the bus and you stop it at the bus stop, that when they spot it more than 18 inches away from the curb, that they deploy the ramp or the lift for somebody who may need it or upon request. So that is now in there. ADA paratransit eligible riders can also use metro buses and trains without paying a fare, and they can also have a PCA with them for not paying the fare. Also, one thing that we did with the people getting onto the bus, I tried to get the modification of the rule book so that the person has to be secured, which means either holding onto a stanchion or a handrail or seated, and unfortunately I couldn't get that. So what I did get was the person must be behind the safety line. If you look, the safety line is that yellow or white line that's right behind the bus operator, where it says don't go beyond this line and talk to the operator. Okay, so the person must be behind that. So anywhere behind that, the operator can start the bus, providing that there's space for them to go back. We have some lines that are what we call crush loads. So we have a lot of people that are on there. One person gets off, one person can get on. That's how bad they are. So if the person can move back and it's open, they must be behind that safety line before they move the bus. Okay, if they are not, again, we need to know so that we can correct it with the operators. One of the other things we're looking at is our website. Our website was not accessible to a lot of people. We were sued on it. In fact, they just settled the lawsuit yesterday. And one of the issues in there is that none of the stuff in there could be used. So we're going to be developing a monitoring program where different people around the agency will be able to monitor to make sure that the site has can be read and people can their reader can use it when they're in their own home. Until that time, until the thing is fully accessible, which means that we still have 40,000 pages worth of stuff in there that is not accessible. In the top right-hand corner, the second line has a little spot there for text only. And you can click on that, and everything from there on in that section or on that page is accessible. So our trip planner is accessible. We're working on the aspect of getting the times accessible off of the schedules. For whatever reason, we have a problem. It's a legal issue dealing with a proprietary software. That's the way they explained it to me. that we can't do certain things, and one of them is to make it useful for people with vision impairments. Don't look at me. I'm just a messenger here. So
we won't hurt you.
Thank you. So we're trying to work through that. And last time I talked to them, they think they got it licked with the guy. Also, the trip planner, we're looking at doing a contract with Google so that they can, if you go into Google, you can access our information. And our information will be, it's basically on any transit system in Los Angeles County. We're working on putting in all the 55 fixed route operators and the 69 dial-a ride systems. We also, as a result of that, we have to put a number on all of our bus stops. So, and part of the 511. You know what the 511 is? Okay, you know what 911 is. You know what 211 is. Okay, 511 is for transportation. Anywhere in the United States, if it's set up, then you can get information on transportation. And LA County, for basically the SCAG region, Southern California Association of Governments, so Ventura, LA, Ventura, Riverside, Long, Orange, San Bernardino, and Imperial counties are going together on this 511 number, and you get information on any of those transit systems within the 511 number. So it's a telephone call. So if you get stranded and you don't know which bus to take, you can call a 511. You get the information just like you would with the trip planner on the computer. Okay. They're hoping to have it kicked off by the first of next year. Okay. Part of that also requires us to put in numbers on all of our bus stops. So we're trying to determine how we're going to do that. That way, if you want to go to a bus stop, it will say go to bus stop 12345. There will be a number on that bus stop that says 12345 that is tacked on in Braille. Okay, so and large print. So we're just figuring out how it is to put that out there, because what we've looked at, the cheapest one that we found so far is going to cost us about $150 per stop. We got 16,000 stops.
Wow.
Okay, so we're trying to figure out how to make this thing work a little bit lesser cost.
Yeah.
Our problem is real simple. We change about 2,000 bus stops every 6 months. So we can't go out and change the numbers on all 2,000 bus stops every 6 months.
Unless they're electronic.
So it's how do you do that within the system that we have? Because we do what we call a shake-up.
Yeah.
And every 6 months we change the schedule. And we try to make it better for what it is at the current program. Remember when I said in 1885, you know, we designed the first system? Okay, well, that's what I'm talking about. Those things back then were fine back in the 1920s and 1930s, but they don't apply to 2008 at all. So as an example, between San Pedro and Long Beach, we have one bus line. There's 43,000 people that go over that bridge every day. We got one bus line that serves that area. So transit is non-existent for that purpose in that area, so we're trying to fix it and make it better. A tap card. A tap card is a like a debit credit card where you can put more, you can add more money to it and take money away from it. So you would add money to a tap card at any ATM or any ticket vending machine in any of our rail lines. You can use your credit card. You can add money to it. When you get onto the bus or the train, you just tap it, and it would automatically take the fare off of that particular card in your account. Be reduced by whatever the fare would be. If the law enforcement then would take that card, put it into a reader to find out if you did tap it or not. If you didn't tap it, then you get a $250 ticket.
Oh.
Okay, it's easier to tap it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot less expensive, too.
Yeah.
I'm getting low on time, so I'm going over, leaving some of the stuff we kind of talked about. On the red line, we're also doing an automatic vehicle annunciator. We got three cars right now that have the annunciator system working in it. So it'll be a little while. We've got like 60 cars, so it'll be a little while before we get it all in there and get it all working. I heard it the other day, and it's not bad. It should tell, though, where you're going to before you get into the train or before the doors are closed. But
yeah, right.
I said, why do operators do things? I don't know. Why they can't tell you where you're going before they close the doors? That doesn't make any sense to me. But we did get the robot change for them on that. The Blue Line also has all the cars, all the trains now have a vehicle annunciator on the Blue Line. And the rail signage, we experimented in our Red Line with a sign that's tactile and in Braille that's on the first set of stairs that goes down at each of the Red Line stations. And it's right on the side, on the platform side, and it tells you where that train goes to. So from that track. So it'll tell you either we'll go to Union Station or we'll go to North Hollywood or Wilshire Western. So we're going to start incorporating that into the whole system. With the East LA extension of the Gold Line, all those stations will have that sign on all the platforms. So you'll be able to know which side to stand on and which direction the train is going in. Unless they go single track, and then that's a different issue. Where the transportation passenger information system, it's like a plasma screen that's set up. We have several of them on the platform. They're in the mezzanine level as you come onto the Red Line. And our goal for that is so that it will be live information that will tell people when the next train will come in. It will also have a verbal announcement. And it will tell you which track you should be standing on, the left or the right track, to be standing on in order to if you want to go to where it is that you want to go. So as the train is approaching, it will say that the Union Station train is due in 2 minutes, as an example. Mm-hmm. So far, they haven't been able to keep up with the schedule they printed, so they haven't figured out how to do the real-time stuff yet. We're working on a between-car barrier so that people with vision impairments won't fall in between the rail cars. We're looking at a platform barrier, and we're hoping that will work so that it will stop you before you get to the space in between the coupling area in between the cars. We had a gentleman last year that fell off the platform in between the cars on the Blue Line. And the Blue Line's grandfathered in, but if we can do a platform barrier, then we can do it on all the Blue Line stations as well. So we spent over $4 million in trying to develop a barrier that's going to be on a train car. Nothing has worked for both sides. We have one that's out there right now, but it doesn't work for us. It costs us $1 million a year to maintain it, and we put four operators in the hospital for it. So we want to change that. Like I said, our Gold Line extension to East Los Angeles will open up in June of 2009. The Exposition Line is under construction. That will open in late 2010. We have a half-cent sales tax on the ballot, which we call Measure R, and it will be constructing different things if that passes. As well as sending money back to the cities for road repairs. About 15% can go back to the cities. So if you want the flashcards or the Braille map, and you didn't get one today, Marie Trevelyan, and I'll spell that for you, Marie, M-A-R-I-E, Trevelyan, T-E-R-A-L-O-N. Her number is 213-922-7023, and she'd be glad to send it out to you. Now we got a few questions, and Donna's got the. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, hello. My name is Braden Hogarden from High Desert. My question is this: where are we on the front of connecting community to community? Since I'm in the High Desert, there really isn't any transportation other than Greyhound to go down the hill.
Last time I heard is that the Southern California Regional Rail Agency, which SCRA, the agency responsible for Metrolink, talked to the rail company. The rail company said, sure, we'd be glad to rent you a space for $200 million a year for one train. So basically it's non-existent.
How is MTA handling outreach to non-English speakers, both to potential recipients of ADA services and, more important, to alerting the general public as to their obligations vis-a-vis ADA accommodations? I see a lot of people I'm from Northern California, and on buses I see a lot of cases where people that don't give up the priority seating. And it seems to be because they haven't been informed and their culture doesn't teach them to do that?
That's an excellent question. We've been debating how to do that. We do have a proposed bus rider rule book, for lack of a better word, that's on our website. You're welcome to take a look at that and make comments on that. My feeling is it goes overboard because there's too much negativism in it. It tells you what you can't do. It doesn't really do what it is. I don't think it does what we want it to do. Right now, that's our only thing that we have that we're developing. Other than when we open up a rail line, we go out into the schools and we work with the school kids and we explain to them the ethics and responsibilities and stuff of riding onto our buses and trains and how to be courteous with other people and all the different rules that they need to work through. That program, just to give you an idea, we did not do it when the blue line opened, and unfortunately there have been a lot of people with disabilities, a lot of people who have passed away because they didn't know how to handle a train down the tracks. We did it for the Gold Line very extensively to all the schools. There were 77 schools within a half a mile of the Gold Line. We've had 3 accidents on the Gold Line since it opened up in 2003. 2 of them, they hit us. One of them, the person was thrown out of a car accident on the freeway and came up and went to the windshield of our train that was coming. So we basically haven't really had any accidents on the Gold Line per se, based upon what we did on the Blue Line. So we think that's really the way to go out and do it, is the education of going out and hitting the schools, because that goes home and that helps. There's 150 languages. You're not going to hit everybody. It is already. Yes.
Okay, I'm from Southern California. I ride the Red Line a lot, and what I have find with the Red Line is that when they make announcements in the Red Line, it's not very clear because it echoes all through the echoes through there, and I was just curious, you know, when we're standing and waiting for a Red Line. It echoes a lot.
One of the first things I did when I came back into Metro in 2003, I made the comment that the speakers that we have in the rail cars and in the stations is incorrect. It's the wrong type of speakers. I also said that you need to train your operators how to use a microphone.
You don't want them to go like this.
Okay, you don't want them to go like this either. So you want them to understand how it is to use it. So they've been working very hard on doing that. The other aspect is that we're on the 8th generation of our PA system in the rail line, which means that we, whatever reason, don't ask me, I don't know why, we cannot seem to buy something that's worthwhile to put onto the Red Line that's going to help people.
Chip, it's called always using the lowest bidder. That's what it's called. You mentioned, and I ought to know given who I work for, you mentioned going to the longer buses. And you and I had a conversation the other day, and I didn't get to Steve Rank. He's still on vacation. But if Metro is going to buses that are longer, some thought needs to be given to the placement of the bus stops. The situation that I deal with downtown, the Foothill and the Metro stops are too close together for the Metro drivers to use conveniently if there's a Foothill bus parked there. And this might be something that I'll need to bring to the advisory committee, because if we're going to the longer buses, you have to deal with those bus stops and where they're placed, so that they take into account the fact that the buses indeed are longer.
Yeah, the 90-foot buses are going to only be operated on a guideway, so the transitway. It'll be the Canoga transitway that we're going to be building. That's the only place they're going to be operated.
But
because
nonetheless,
they're not allowed to go on city streets.
Yeah, but nonetheless, the Foothill, the Silver Streak, is a longer bus. And that's the genesis of the problems that I have downtown with the buses, the Metro buses pulling up behind the Silver Streak and not seeing around the Silver Streak to the fact that there are passengers waiting where the Metro is supposed to stop.
Right. I don't have an answer, Mitch.
See, that's what I like about him. He'll say, I don't have an answer.
Or I could answer you this way. Can you understand what I'm saying?
I can, Gene.
I was wondering, how successful are you, your training department in training the operators to recognize that when they have a green light and a pedestrian has a green light going the same direction and they make a right turn, to yield the right of way to somebody with a cane?
You want an answer?
I was just wondering how successful that training.
I don't really know how they do the training on that, Gene.
Okay.
Anybody else? One to your right, Donna. Actually, there's two to your right. The gentleman and the lady.
Okay. And
okay, lady goes first.
I just have a quick question. Is when I board one of your buses, is it my responsibility to ask the other passenger to vacate the seat that's available for me as a handicap? Because I found this the other day, and I did it, you know, with, I thought maybe the driver would do it, but they didn't do it, and I had to ask the other passenger to please move because there were other seats available. And the passenger did it, but they really didn't want to. They didn't like being asked to move.
The operator is required to ask the people to move, but they're not required to enforce it. The difference comes here is that the operator may have already asked them and they already told the operator to go do something with his anatomy.
Okay.
And we, unfortunately, we don't know that. You don't know that either. You don't know what transpired before you got on. But that's something that could have happened. So the operator is reluctant to even ask them, continuing to ask them to move. You would hope that eventually they get the idea and they would move. We stress the concept that they are to request that people move from those seats so that people with disabilities and seniors can be accommodated. That's the concept that we're having by making this area a different color-coded area, and we're going to put in different signage that's going to be saying something along that lines. And basically something to the effect that, please vacate the priority seating area when requested or something like that.
Hold on one sec.
You can ask anything. There's no issue with that. You can ask. And you can also ask the operator to ask the people to move as well. Okay, I think we have one more, and then we're getting the high sign, like, get the heck out of this room.
The hook.
Okay, I took the 439 bus here this morning, and I had a problem hearing the next stop annunciator. It was very low, but it seemed like the messages for the weather, the news, the advertisement was louder, and it seemed to get even louder as the bus moved. And I think that's a conflict and a problem. I think the annunciator should be on the same kind of system where it would be get louder as well. I mentioned to the bus driver that I wanted to get off at Airport and Century. And I said that twice to her, but I had ended up, she didn't want me to come up to the front because of the lower floor bus. I was, behind the rear well, and I ended up getting off at Century and Aviation, which, I had to walk back. But if the annunciator was loud enough, I think I would have been able to get off at the right stop.
The annunciator is designed so that when the annunciator with the TV is designed so that when a an announcement of the annunciator is made, then the TV is supposed to go mute. Now, like all buses or all things that are made, some things don't work exactly the way that they're supposed to. So if you know the direction that you're going in, and if you know the bus stop you got on, the time and the date, then you can tell us, and we can pinpoint which bus that is and go back and fix the problem. Okay, but we need to know that. So you need to tell us. You need to call us and tell us so we can fix it.
Yeah. Right.
Okay? So I apologize for the problem. But as soon as we know it, then they go out very quickly and fix the problem.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to thank you, Chip, for coming this morning and updating us on what your system is doing. Very much informative. And let's give Chip Hazen a hand. And also I'd like to thank Donna Pomerantz for helping us set this up. And overall, in closing, I would like to also thank Ken Metz for having helped us get arrangement for the hybrid demonstration. He deserves that hand, too. There will be some discussions on access and things at this afternoon's Committee on Access Transportation meeting, which is in Salon B as in Boy at approximately 4:15. We'll be talking a little bit about stair striping regulations and elevator call buttons locations. So hope you'll be able to attend. Thank you and have a good afternoon.